If you'd like to turn your Bibles to 1 Samuel chapter 4, we'll kind of use that as a springboard text, and then we'll move over to Matthew 5 in just a minute. Thank you again for the opportunity to share in this special day with you today. Appreciate the invitation to come and to speak and to get to see folks that I've known for a number of years, and then also to get to meet some folks I've just known recently. A young man came up to me and said, "Hey, I was in Mountain Home, Arkansas last weekend when you spoke." I apologize to you, young man, because it's the same topics. But so he's getting a rerun. And then Don Purvis is here. Don, where are you at? Don, stand up. Don is my stunt double. If I do anything or say anything you don't like, try to find him and pretend it's me. It's not hard to do. Thank you, brother. I love you and appreciate you. I heard all these rumors about having a twin. And then Don and I ran into each other several years ago somewhere. And it's frightening that we look so much alike for, I guess, maybe from his perspective or mine. I don't know which one. Anyway, it's good to see Don here too. 1 Samuel 4 is kind of an interesting text. It starts out, "And the word of Samuel came to all Israel." That's an inaugural phrase. The writer's telling us that now the prophet in Israel is Samuel, no longer Eli. So with this inaugural verse, we get this story. Now, Israel went out to battle against the Philistines. They encamped beside Ebenezer, and the Philistines encamped in Aphek. Then the Philistines put themselves in battle array against Israel. And when they joined battle, Israel was defeated by the Philistines, who killed about 4,000 men of the army of the field. When the people had come to the camp, the elders of Israel said, "Why has the Lord defeated us today before the Philistines? Let us bring the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord from Shiloh, that when it comes among us, it may save us from the hand of our enemies." So the people sent to Shiloh that they might bring from there the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord of Hosts, who dwells between the cherubim. And the two sons of Eli, Hophni and Phinehas, were there with the Ark of the Covenant of God. When the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord came into the camp, all Israel shouted so loudly that the earth shook. Now when the Philistines heard the noise of the shout, they said, What does this shout in the camp of the Hebrews mean?" And then they understood that the Ark of the Lord had come into the camp. So the Philistines were afraid, and they said, "God has come into the camp. Woe to us, for such a thing has never happened before. Woe to us, who will deliver us from the hand of these mighty gods? These are the gods who struck the Egyptians with all the plagues in the wilderness." You've got an Old Testament battle scene. Now, two armies, they meet on a plain, or usually with a small valley in between them. One army will stand on this side, one army on the other, and they'll shout at each other. They'll work themselves into a frenzy. And then at some signal, the armies will come down and they'll engage. I'm not sure we comprehend warfare at all. There's gentlemen here who were in World War II, Vietnam, maybe some guys recently been in the Middle East. They got a comprehension. But at the same time, modern warfare and what these guys were doing, the difference is almost incomprehensible. The Israelites would have had long poles. On top of those poles would have been a banner. We sing songs in our songbooks about under his banner, or unfurl the banner, under the banner of the Lord. Even use the phrase a standard. That's a pole with a flag on it. Every tribe of Israel had an animal mascot. The tribe of Judah had a lion. Jesus is descended from the tribe of Judah. That's why he's called the Lion of Judah. He's the Passover lamb, so he can be the lion and the lamb. But these guys didn't have uniforms. They didn't have a jersey with a Star of David, you know, on the back. And so when they ran into this field and they started fighting with each other, you'd look for one of those banners. And if it was a banner you recognized, if it was one of the tribes of Israel, you'd fight your way to it. And that way you'd be surrounded, or at least in a group of your own men as you fought. And again, we really don't. Can't comprehend the descriptions of this kind of fighting. If you want to get just a teeny taste of it, think about the guys who cage fight. The guys in the UFC, probably the most elite athletes on the planet. And yet their matches last 15 minutes, 3 5-minute rounds. And when those guys finish a 5-minute round, they are exhausted. But both those guys will walk out of that ring alive. Imagine being in a field of battle where you're exerting yourself physically and you can't have a referee intervene, you can't have a bell ring, you can't stop. Maybe just a taste of what that exhaustion would be like. If you want a good description of maybe Old Testament warfare, go to Walmart. Now, that's not the part that's like warfare. But buy one of those $7 machetes. That machete has better steel in it than they had in the Old Testament. Go out into the forest and find you an old pine tree that's been blown over. Take that machete and start at one end of that tree and cut those limbs off all the way to the top of that tree as you walk across the trunk. The first time you mislick one of those limbs and you don't get it, you just compromised yourself in an Old Testament battle. The first time your hand gets so sweaty that when you hit that limb, that machete blade turns and you don't get a good purchase, you just died in an Old Testament battle. About the time you get so exhausted you can't swing that thing again, you died in an Old Testament battle. These men from the army of Israel and the men from the army of the Philistines run down toward each other, and with clubs and sticks and primitive knives and bows and spears, they fight each other to the death. The person controlling the battle is going to be on the hillside, and he's going to have a trumpet, and he's watching his men. And he sees an Israelite fall, and an Israelite fall, and an Israelite fall, and an Israelite fall. And he recognizes they're suffering such great losses in the field. They need to retreat. So they blow the trumpet and they disengage and they move back up the hill. In this camp meeting, they why has God defeated us among the Philistines? Maybe a little tongue in cheek, but everybody, you know, hey, did you guys bring your weapons? Everybody bring your helmet? Everybody got a breastplate? What's going on here? And then somebody finally says, hey, Ark of the Covenant. We're supposed to go in the battle with the Ark of the Covenant. So they send the Shiloh and they get the Ark of the Covenant, a box, cubit and a half by cubit and a half deep, overlaid in hammered gold. On top of the box was a lid known as the mercy seat. The mercy seat had carved on top of it two figures that were called cherubim. A cherubim is a four-winged angel. A seraphim is a six-winged angel. The seraphim are usually humanoid. The cherubim typically had animal bodies and human faces. On top of the mercy seat, the wings would cover their faces and two of their wings would overstretch. And when God came into the camp, His essence would descend between those angels, why He's called the God who dwelled among the cherubim. So they go into Shiloh and they get the Ark of the Covenant, and it's their symbol of their agreement, their covenant, their relationship with God. And as they bring this ark into the camp, Israel shouts. The Bible says they shouted so loud that the earth shook. If you doubt that, do a little research. LSU played Auburn, I think in a home game. And when they won the game in the last second, their fans shouted so loud that it registered on the Richter scale in the science department at LSU. Do a little research. Look it up. These guys come into the camp with the Ark of the Covenant, and Israel shouts. And when the Philistines hear the shout, they get panicked. Woe unto us, a God is in the camp. And then they make this statement. These are the gods that struck the Egyptians with the plagues in the wilderness. Hey, folks, there's no CNN. There's no Facebook. How do people who live that far away from Egypt know what happened to the Egyptians? The power and the fame of God has spread. The power of God is with the Israelites. So the Philistines decide not to let this ark be a turning point for them. Verse 9, be strong, conduct yourselves like men, you Philistines, that you do not become servants of the Hebrews as they have been to you. Conduct yourselves like men and fight. So the Philistines fought. And Israel was defeated. Did you expect that? You go to Shiloh and you get the Ark of the Covenant, and then the verse is, and the Philistines fought and Israel was defeated. And every man fled to his tent. There was a great slaughter. And they're filling Israel that day, 30,000 foot soldiers. And the Ark of God was captured, and the two sons of Eli, Hophni and Phinehas, died. I remember reading that as a boy and thinking, that didn't end right. They did what they were supposed to do. They went and got the Ark, and they brought the Ark into battle. And when the Ark leads them into battle, they're supposed to win. What's wrong? What's wrong with the power of the Ark? Obviously nothing. What's wrong with the power of God? Nothing. What's wrong with Israel? They didn't have enough faith. I beg your pardon. 4,000 men have just died in this valley. You go back into camp and you sit there, and the only difference it makes is this box comes into the camp. And you follow a box back down into a meat grinder. Don't tell me these men didn't have faith. They put their faith in the Ark of the Covenant and followed it back down into death. Don't tell me these guys didn't have faith. So what was wrong? I believe they're guilty of what happens to us so many times, in that we perform actions without being the kind of people we're supposed to be. I've often phrased it in a very inarticulate or a not very sophisticated way, is doing without being. And the essence of raising spiritually self-reliant children is to first and foremost instill into our children a spiritual self-identity. What you do doesn't make you what you are. What you are determines what you do. And if we ever fail to align that properly, if we ever put the cart before the horse, we end up raising generations of people and focusing our relationship with God on ritual rather than relationship. In their corruption of the Old Testament, in their manifestation of Judaism in the intertestamental period, the Jews worshiped the law and had no relationship with the lawgiver. In fact, if you turn to Matthew chapter 5, when Jesus is speaking to the crowd, Matthew chapter 5, 6, and 7, we call the Sermon on the Mount. And it's essentially a very, very long discussion where Jesus talks about internals versus externals. It's where Jesus talks about actions versus attitude. It's where Jesus confronts the concept of doing without being. These people didn't have an identity. They just had a list of rituals. In fact, if you look at Matthew 5, say 1 through about 15, he talks about attitudes. We call them the Beatitudes. He gives an absolute great discourse on being blessed, being happy in spite of circumstances. Blessed are the poor in spirit. Blessed are those who mourn. Blessed are the meek. He talks to them about, and this word he uses for blessed is a word that means happiness and contentment in spite of external circumstances. He was making a play on a word that was used to describe the state of the gods. And then after he talks about the Beatitudes, he gives kind of a disclaimer. Verse 17. Do not think that I came to destroy the law and the prophets. I did not come to destroy, but to fulfill. If you start out a statement, now I don't want you to hurt, I don't want to hurt your feelings. Now I don't want to make you mad. I don't want you to think I'm angry. If somebody starts a statement like that, what are they about to say? Yeah, you're about to have a bad day. Jesus is telling these people, I'm about to say some things that you're going to find to be controversial. Don't get the idea. Don't think I came to destroy. I didn't come to destroy. I came to fulfill. In fact, he says the law had such integrity that one jot or one tittle wouldn't pass away until it was fulfilled. A jot is a dot. In a tittle, if you draw with a pen that you dip in the ink and you're drawing and you move and you get a piece of fiber on the end of your pen and it drags across the paper, makes kind of a little ink trail, that's a tittle. Jesus said, you won't lose a stroke of a pen out of the law until it's fulfilled. And I've come to tell you how to fulfill the law. And then in the verse that the young man read for us, "For I say to you that unless your righteousness exceeds the scribes and the Pharisees, you will by no means enter the kingdom of heaven." Let's suppose that you have a guest speaker. He walks into the pulpit and says, "I'd like your elders to stand," and they stand. "I'd like your ministers to stand," and they stand. And he says, "If you don't do better than they're doing, you're going to hell." Folks, you'd have to fight your way into the pulpit to put your hands on him. A man came in here and insulted your leaders that way. That's just what Jesus has said. If you don't do better, unless your righteousness exceeds the scribes and the Pharisees, you will not enter the kingdom of heaven. This is what they're teaching you. And this is what I'm about to teach you. And then the rest of his lesson is about internals versus externals. Just kind of cherry picking a few verses. Notice what he says in verse 21. "You've heard it said." Now when he says "you've heard it said," he's talking about the Pharisees and the scribes, and he's quoting the rabbis. I've got a little book that was given to me as a gift called the Mishnah. It's about an 800 sentence commentary or 800 commentaries expansion on the law of Moses. It wasn't just enough for them to take the law of Moses. They had to go ahead and say, "Well, this is what it actually means." "You've heard it said, you shall not murder. And whoever murders will be in danger of the judgment. And I say to you, whoever is angry with his brother without a cause will be in danger of the judgment. And whoever says to your brother, Rakos, shall be in danger of the council. And whoever says, you fool, shall be in danger of hellfire. Therefore, if you bring your gift to the altar and your brother, remember your brother has something against you, leave your gift before the altar and go your way and be reconciled to your brother and then come and offer your gift." Jesus says, you've heard these people talk about, don't murder. And there is a distinction in the language between killing and murder. I don't know that I've ever been in an audience where I've asked the question, anybody here ever murdered anybody? Anybody raise their hand? I know we've got veterans and soldiers and police officers, and they've had to kill in the line of duty. That's different. I remember getting asked to speak in a summer series, and they said, we want you to come over, and they want me to drive about 4 hours and want you to speak on thou shalt not kill. I said, I think I'll pass on that. I don't think it's a big problem with our brethren. I think we struggle with that from day to day. Jesus says, you've heard it said by those of old, don't kill. Well, if I ask this audience, anybody here ever murdered anybody? Chances are very, very small that anybody raised their hand. We may have some soldiers or some veterans that have done violence in war. That's not what it's talking about. But suppose I ask the question, you ever hated anybody? You ever looked at anybody and said, you fool? You dweeb? Queer, fag, insert any ethnic slur you want to put out there. Well, the vast majority of the people in this room never put their hands on anybody in violence. But what have we thought in our hearts toward people who are created in the image of God and who Jesus came to die for? I don't want to go too far afield, but the LGBTQ movement, the same-sex marriage movement. Please understand, those folks are not your enemy. They are victims of your enemy. They have violated God's law. They violated God's will. They are perverting what God said was supposed to be pure and innocent and holy. But they're not your enemy. And when we can look at them and talk about those people, then not only does the devil get to send them to hell, he gets to let us go with them, because although we wouldn't murder them, we hate them. See, the difference in murder and hate is one's internal, one's external. The difference in murder and hate is that if I do violence to you, everybody knows it. But if I harbor something in my heart towards you and I judge you because of your color or because of your choices, or because of anything else, and if I see you as anything else, if I label you with anything other than you're created in the image of God and Jesus died for you, if I see you with any other set of glasses, I'm guilty of murder in my heart. He says, if you come to worship, if you bring your gift to the altar, and you remember your brother has something against you, he doesn't say your brother has a clue. He doesn't say your brother has a legitimate claim. He says, you remember you've got unfinished business with your brother, and you take care of it. You leave your gift at the altar and you go handle it. I've heard people debate that I don't have to forgive somebody unless they ask for forgiveness. That's ridiculous. When Jesus is on the cross and they are murdering him, he says, Father, forgive them. They know not what they do. They were not penitent. But he was closing the gap and making reconciliation. Oh, we may sit and we may tell our children, oh, we've never hurt anybody. We've never murdered anybody. We've never put hands on anybody in violence. But if we hate people and we label people and we're harsh to people, Jesus says, internally, you've killed them anyway. Another example, verse 27. You've heard it said by those of old, you shall not commit adultery. But I say to you, whoever looks at a woman to lust at her has already committed adultery with her in his heart. If your right eye causes you to sin, pluck it out and cast it from you. For it's more profitable for you that one of your members perish than your whole body be cast into hell. And if your right hand causes you to sin, you cut it off and cast it from you. For it's more profitable for you that one member perish than for your whole body to be cast into hell. What's the difference between lust and adultery? Well, if you're out here cheating on your spouse, somebody figure that out. If you get involved in exchanging text messages or get involved in an emotional affair on Facebook or Instagram, that's going to come to light. There's a record of that. But if you look at people and you fantasize about them as sexual objects, the only person who knows about that is you and God. And gentlemen, let me tell you, especially you younger gentlemen, the message you're giving yourself about what sexuality is a message that will affect your entire life. When fantasy competes with reality, fantasy always wins. And you create an expectation that can never be fulfilled by a living human being. And young ladies, when you read romance novels, it's the same thing. You're creating a fantasy versus reality and fantasy. You ever got the chicken sandwich at Wendy's that's in the window? You drive down the road and you see that thing and say, I'm going to have one of those. You pull in and it's Tweety Bird on the bun. They've never found that chicken sandwich. Well, you think about when you pretend that that's your relationship or this is what... And please, young men, understand. If you're responding to the beauty of these ladies, God made you to do that. He made you to appreciate their grace and their beauty. If you're between the ages of 13 and 23, you have a thought about sex every 7 seconds if you're an average male. That's an average male. I'm not talking about that creepy little seventh grader who wants to hug everybody in the youth group, okay? I'm talking about the average person. And it's okay and it's healthy. The problem is that when you have that thought, and instead of, oh, she's beautiful or she's wonderful, you begin to undress her with your eyes and touch her with your mind. When it becomes a fantasy, gentlemen, that's when it's lust. Stay away from it, because Jesus says, although you've never actually put your hands on somebody, you're guilty of impurity. And young ladies, don't buy into the technical definition of virginity. Don't buy into the idea that just because there's a line that somebody hadn't crossed that God sees you as pure. God sees you as pure when he looks in your heart. It's not about some arbitrary place that we make off out of bounds on our bodies. It's just the state of our heart. And just because you've never gone all the way doesn't mean you're pure in God's eyes if you're playing these games. Jesus talks about internals versus externals. We're running out of time, so we'll skip a little bit. Look at verse 43. You've heard it said, you shall love your neighbor and hate your enemy. Now, folks, that's pretty simple math. I can do that. These are the people I love. These are the people I throw rocks at. You've heard it said, love your neighbor, hate your enemy. But I say to you, love your enemies. Bless those who curse you. Do good to those who hate you. Pray for those who spitefully use you and persecute you. And you'll be elected to the student government. You'll be the president of the homeowners association. You'll get invited to all the nicer parties. Your Bible probably doesn't read that way, does it? Mine doesn't either. But I say to you, love your enemies. Bless those who curse you. Do good to those who hate you. Pray for those who spitefully use you and persecute you in order that you may be sons of your Father who is in heaven. You do what you do. You treat people the way you treat people. It has nothing to do with their behavior. It has everything to do with your internalization of your identity. If I am a child of God, there are some things I cannot say to you. If I am a child of God, there's things I cannot do to you or with you. As a child of God, I can't cheat. As a child of God, I can't lie. See, doing those things doesn't make me a child of God. Not doing those things doesn't make me a child of God. But when I have an internal locus of control, when I have a spiritual self-identity, when what I am is a child of God, then I've already predetermined what I'm going to do. And Jesus fought against the idea that internal versus... In chapter 6, he talks about fasting and giving and praying. And in all three instances, he ends his discussion with, "And your Father who sees in secret will reward you openly." If you do anything of a religious nature with the idea of impressing people, you're wrong. Christians are not in the business of impressing. We're in the business of influencing. And you don't do the things you do so that people say anything about you. You do the things you do because it's consistent with how you've identified yourself as a child of God. And parents, if you want to change your young people, college students, if you want to really make your Christianity authentic, get out of the idea of there's a list of do's and don'ts and understand you live by one concept. As a child of God, can I do this and make my identity consistent? Can I make these choices or take these things or do these activities and be consistent with how I see myself? When Jesus closes the Sermon on the Mount, he talks about two builders. And I'm afraid we've taken that example and just merely turned it into a vacation Bible school song. But the story of the two builders is not the idea that you have a house over here that looks like something was built by Benton Holmes, and then over here you like something that one of the Three Little Pigs built. You've got these two houses and they look the same. And in verse 25 and verse 27, both houses get exactly the same weather. And the rain descended, the floods came, the winds blew and beat on that house. Christianity doesn't insulate you from bad things. Christianity doesn't stop you from having storms in your life. Christianity doesn't keep you from having problems with your family. Christianity doesn't mean that there are not going to be difficulties at home. Christianity doesn't mean that you're not going to have physical difficulties. Christianity says that when you have something underneath your house, something internal, something unseen, something foundational, then it doesn't matter what happens to your house. We've almost been guilty, and I think a lot of us have fallen prey to therapeutic moralistic deism, that we cross all our T's and dot all our I's, and then everything's good. And then if somebody gets cancer or somebody dies or somebody's house burns, then for some reason God's not real or God doesn't love us. God said both houses get the same weather. And the houses that stand have something underneath them that nobody else can see. Jesus' entire discussion is about internals versus externals. And young people and parents, if we don't develop a sense of who we are and whose we are, then when we go out into the world and we carry our religion on our shoulders and we meet Satan for the first time, he'll defeat us and take our box because we've put externals before internals. When you decide what you are, you have predetermined what you do. I have the privilege of running an obstacle course. It's called a ropes course, similar to the thing you have over at Mid-South. We've got a giant swing. You get hooked to it, and we wrap a strap around, and your team pulls you into the air about 55 feet. When you're up there off the ground, you look at your guy on the ground, you say, is the lane clear? Lane is clear. I'm swinging. Swing on. And you open your hand, and that little strap unravels, and Mr. Gravity never sleeps, and you're going for a ride. We get our groups off the swing, and I ask them, when did you decide to turn loose of that strap? And you get different answers when you told me I could, when I quit praying or whatever. But my answer is always the same. You decided to turn loose of that strap before you ever got up in the air, or you would never got on the ladder. Your decisions to be pure on a date, those decisions are made months before you ever start dating. Your decisions to be honest with your marriage vows, gentlemen, are made years before you're in the back room of an office with a flirty secretary. Your decisions to drink or not drink or do drugs are made months before you're at a party and somebody hands one to you. Because when you decide what you are, you've pre-decided what you'll do. And parents, if we're going to raise spiritually self-reliant children, we've got to instill in them a spiritual self-identity. 3 John 4 says, I have no greater joy than to hear that my children walk in the truth. We make the mistake and we define our children as A students and B students and varsity players and college athletes. And there's nothing wrong with making good grades and being a good athlete. But it ought to be that we focus our children on, this is God's student. She makes A's. This is God's student. He makes C's. This is God's student. He's a quarterback. This is God's student. They march in the band. But until we focus our attention and our energy on our children and tell them we're God's children and the other things we do are just manifestations of how God can use us, then we'll never have a spiritual self-identity and we'll never raise spiritually self-reliant children. You may be struggling with how to instill spirituality in your home. 25, 30 years ago, I was on a retreat. When you're a young youth minister and you show up at a retreat, they go, Brother Jones, we'll let you sleep with the boys. Nowadays, I go somewhere and they go, Brother Jones, we've got a cabin for you near the director's hut. You don't have one. In the days when I used to sleep with the kids, I'd go in and find a top bunk in the corner. That way you're protected on two sides. I usually travel with a big knife, and I put that knife in the rafters hanging upside down. Look around that cabin and go, you boys be quiet. I'm likely not to have a flashback. And you just lay down, and I usually don't bother you. And I was at this event, and the lights were out. And this voice, 15-year-old boy. Lonzo. Oh boy, here it comes. What? Lonzo. Turned his light on. I leaned over my bunk. Get ready. What's your favorite Bible verse? What? I usually ask everybody what their verse is. I didn't ask you. I've been playing ball with them, been wrestling with them, been doing push-ups with them. Had taught a few devotionals. It's after midnight. 15-year-old boy asked me what my favorite Bible verse is. I piled off that bunk, sat down on a dirt concrete floor, camp for the deaf. Down near Gunnersville, Alabama. 3 or 4 boys gathered around me. And we talked about the Bible like you talk about NASCAR or football or hunting. Conversational spirituality. Not, hey, let's get our family together and have a devo. No. When you sit down, when you rise up, when you lie down, as you walk in the way, it's on your gate, it's on your door. I called it conversational spirituality, where your home is permeated by a relationship with God, not something you only do 3 times a week. That young man's in this audience. They're traveling. He brought his daughter to Freed. I didn't know they were here. Maybe Chad Smith, and my friend for years, was on the SWAT team for years, one of our snipers. And he taught me the value of having an identity that says, I talk about my God, and I talk about my Maker, and I talk about His Word at midnight in a dirt floor on a camp, not at some ritualized place. And when who you are translate to conversations in the car and at the table and at dinner and at the park and at the ball field and when you're rising up and when you're lying down, when they see that we have a relationship with God because we are His children, then what we are is real and authentic. And what our children become is then real and authentic. Question number one, are you a child of God? Not have you been through a ritual, but have you in a relationship with God where your faith is so strong that it affects the way you think? Do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind. Romans 12 says that we change when we think differently about ourselves. Cognitive behavioral therapy says as you think, you act. When your faith is so strong, it affects your thought process. Not what you do, but how you think. Then how you think affects what you do, because after faith and repentance, a person confesses that their Lord is Jesus. And then you die to self, you're buried, and you rise and walk a new life. Are you a child of God? If you've never been baptized, you're not a child of God. If you've never been baptized, you're still under the penalty of sin. If you have been baptized, but it's been a ritual instead of a relationship, then you can't be spiritually self-reliant because you're basing your acts on your goodness rather than God's grace and God's mercy. In either case, if you're not a baptized believer or if you're not a mature, faithful baptized believer, we offer an invitation. One of the elders will stand here. I'll be here. If you have a need, we can study with you. We can pray with you. We can study with you. Or we can baptize you. Make sure your relationship with God is based on internals and not just externals. Come this morning while we stand, while we sing.